content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Jennifer King Lindley is titled Wonder Woman. During trying times, we crave answers. But according to the growing field of philosophical counseling, the real power is in asking the questions. 10 months into quarantine, the passage of time began to confuse me. Life became smaller, and the graywash routine of it made the hours creep by. At the same time, I felt my real life was flashing by somewhere out there, a trail of missed opportunities in its wake. In December, my elderly in-laws died of COVID. 1, 2, a painful reminder of death's inevitability. Sitting silently on my sofa between slugs of warming wine, I pondered in earnest. Was I using my time here well? I had experienced depression before and been gratefully righted by therapy and medication. This was different. This stew felt more existential. I decided to consult a philosophical counselor. I'd come across the concept during some 2 a.m. doom scrolling. A newish breed of helpers, philosophical counselors, may have a master's or a PhD in philosophy, but have stepped out of the lecture hall to use their insights in helping clients work through thorny life issues, such as midlife crises, relationship dilemmas, career crossroads. Some are certified through the American Philosophical Practitioners Association, APPA, or the National Philosophical Counseling Association, NPCA. But because there's no legal regulation of the field, anyone with a philosophy background could call herself a philosophical counselor. Unlike psychotherapists, they don't diagnose or treat mental health conditions like clinical depression or panic disorder, or prescribe medication, and most don't take insurance. Instead, they lead you through sessions to whip your thinking into shape, like personal trainers for the mind and soul. Having first appeared in the U.S. in the 1990s, philosophical counselors use a variety of approaches. Most engage you in deep conversation, pulling from their training to help you question the logic and assumptions behind your thinking. Some practitioners might suggest you read a little Jean-Paul Sartre or Lao Tzu, or quote tidbits from philosophy's great minds who, over the millennia, have worried about the same problems troubling you today. If you're struggling with feeling disconnected from a friend, for example, they may share Aristotle's views on friendship so you can see your own situation in a different light. Philosophy has a rep as navel-gazing. It's seen as a series of rare-field brain teasers about the sound of one hand clapping or the number of angels that fit on the end of a pin. But Sky Cleary, Ph.D., a lecturer of philosophy at Barnard College, and co-editor of How to Live a Good Life, A Guide to Choosing Your Personal Philosophy, begs to differ. For thousands of years, philosophy, which means love of wisdom, wasn't confined to the ivory tower, she says. It was happening on the streets. Socrates and company led pupils through dialogues to coax greater self-understanding. Asking, why are we here, how should we live, was not just an intellectual exercise. Epicurus believed philosophy was essentially medicine for the soul, a practice with useful applications for solving the problems of everyday life. Today, philosophical counseling is still a niche field, but it's growing steadily, according to Lou Marinoff, Ph.D., a professor of philosophy at the City College of New York and president of APPA. Not surprisingly, demand for philosophical counselors and for APPA training programs has increased during the pandemic, he reports. According to Cleary, that's because we tend to go through life on autopilot, busy with work, family, our phones, and we don't stop and reflect on the big picture until we run into a crisis. But while crises can be scary, they're also opportunities for growth. As adults, we get out of the habit of asking questions, says Cleary. But if we stop doing so, we become passive. Things happen to us rather than us seizing our own destiny. Seeking help with my own questions, I met my modern-day Socrates via Zoom. Monica Villauer, Ph.D., is the founder of Curious Soul Philosophy in Portland, Oregon. Half a continent apart, we bonded over the fear our dogs would interrupt. She had bribed hers with a mini jar of peanut butter. Villauer asked me background questions, much like a therapist would. What was I concerned about? I told her about my quarantine-induced ennui, how I felt stuck in Groundhog Day, fretting I wasn't making use of my time well. Shakespeare wrote King Lear during the plague, right? Like the rest of the planet, I was missing spending time with friends and faraway family, and generally felt unmoored. She listened attentively, then guided me to question my thinking. Has all this solitude perhaps been a time of opportunity, too? While spending lots of time alone, are there ways to feel connected to something outside yourself? I reflected that long walks by the river had been a pleasure, renewing my appreciation of nature. Come to think of it, I had picked up journaling. Villauer shared a few of her experiences, too, giving our session the feel of a conversation. I love Thoreau's ideas about the freedom of solitude, she offered. To paraphrase, he said, when you travel by yourself, you can start any time. Thoreau seemed like good company to be in. Maybe I could view my house as my Walden. As I hung up, I felt like a window had been thrown open in my brain and fresh air had entered. Afterward, I kept mulling over the unlikely positives of this difficult year. I tried seeing the bright side before, but somehow knowing that great thinkers endorsed silver linings made it stick. Unpacking my concerns about my mortality would take additional sessions and more peanut butter. But not all clients seek out philosophical counselors, Hamlet style, to ponder life's big to be or not to be questions. Many come for one session to discuss a specific personal problem, such as a decision to move or an ethical conflict. A client may say her parents expect her to be a lawyer, but she wants to be an artist, says Sean Holland, PhD, a philosophical counselor and consultant in New York City. The expectations of family sit in tension with what she feels, causing her distress. I might ask her to consider, on what grounds do you believe making a lot of money is the measure of success? Philosophical counseling is about reaching down and challenging your deepest assumptions. With or without philosophical counseling, learning to step back and ask questions can be a powerful tool in difficult times. Diana Wu David, author of Future Proof, Reinventing Work in the Age of Acceleration, did just that when she learned that her mother, who had been suffering from breast cancer for 3 years, was about to die. Rather than labeling the experience as devastating, and it was, I committed to being curious about it, she says. I thought about the concept of a good death, what role I could play in helping my mother have one, and if I could learn anything that would eventually help me make that passage too. To that end, David and her mother read Atul Gawande's book, Being Mortal, together. In one of her final days, I brought oranges from the tree in her yard to the hospital for her nurses. Surprisingly, my mother was able to eat one too, recalls David. The smell, the taste, the feel of it, I remember it so vividly. It made me realize how important these small moments are. They are life. The experience didn't just change how David perceived her mother's death, but how she approaches her own day-to-day existence. When difficult things happen, we can try to hide them in a dark corner of our minds, or we can look closely and see what we can learn, she says. I now bring this attitude to everything. When someone is doing something that bothers me, I step back to say to myself, "That's interesting." That pause, combined with curiosity, expands the possibilities of how I can react. While asking philosophical questions can be revolutionary in responding to challenges, the practitioners I talk to emphasize that the approach has its limits. Working through childhood trauma is not necessarily in their wheelhouse, for example. Ryan Howes, PhD, a psychologist in Pasadena, California, and the author of Mental Health Journal for Men, sees it as a useful complement to his field. I am all for philosophy being used as a starting point for trying to make sense of your life. Concepts from philosophy were the basis of cognitive behavioral therapy, he says. But if you're suffering from a psychological disorder, you should be under the care of a physician or psychotherapist. Ann Marinoff notes, a reputable philosophical counselor will be able to tell you, after an initial consultation, whether the issues you raise can best be addressed philosophically or not. Ultimately, philosophy helps you ask the right questions, but won't supply easy answers. There's no secret answer key, says Villauer. Still, the act of questioning helps you consider new perspectives. Cleary told me Simone de Beauvoir believed we are never fully formed, but a series of evolving selves. That may be a philosophical truth, but it's also a practical reminder that we're all works in progress, and that life is a series of new possibilities. Our next article is titled Rise and Shine. We all encounter adversity, but how we cope is key to what happens next. Here are some wise words from luminaries who've told Oprah about their lowest moments and the path to a brand new perspective. Ellen DeGeneres. After I came out, I was on your show and I was on the cover of Time, and there was article after article and then articles reporting on articles, and it became this storm. Then it turned into everybody telling me to shut up. I was getting attacked for talking about it so much, and I was like, I am not talking about it, you are. And then everybody was hating me, and that's when my show Ellen went down in flames. I actually think the show got better after I came out, the season that no one watched. Interrupts Oprah. Turned out to be the best season, I remember. But it's so important to say that out loud so people can also see for themselves how the things that broke you open actually allowed you to be set free. Ellen's response? I think Diane Sawyer told me she read something that said, "The cracks in your heart let the sun shine through." I just thought that was beautiful, and it's all part of balance. Tyler Perry. Oprah. Lots of people think there's something special about me, and they wait for something good to happen, and it doesn't. Why did it happen for you? Tyler's response. Because I never stopped chasing it down. I don't think the dreams die. I think that people give up when it gets too hard. There were so many dark days when I wanted to lie there and die. Oprah, you actually considered suicide? Tyler, yes, when the rainbow wasn't enough. Oprah, what does that feel like, to want to die? Tyler, you feel there's nothing better for you. Oprah, it's the end of hope. So as we sit here now with you looking at how far you've come and where you still have to go, what is it you know for sure? Tyler, what I know beyond a shadow of a doubt is that God is with me. I know that. I know that He's always been with me. It is evident in everything I have endured and the fact that I made it through with some sanity. Paulo Coelho. I call the reason we're here our personal legend. It's as simple as that. You can fill your hours and days with things that are meaningless, but you know you have a reason to be here. It is the only thing that gives you enthusiasm. Oprah, I call it your personal calling. Paulo, yes, and you know that when you lack enthusiasm, you are betraying your personal legend. Oprah, you say that the reason many people never pursue their personal legend is because of their fear of failure. I love this quote from The Alchemist. Don't give in to your fears, said the alchemist in a strangely gentle voice. If you do, you won't be able to talk to your heart. Paulo, every heart is fearful. A heart is like a flower, you know. It can be very brave, but it can be easily hurt. I've been defeated many times, and I fear a lot of things still, but the point is not to give up. Sally Field. Once Gidget was canceled, the producers came up with this flying nun show to get me on the air again. I didn't want to do it, but my stepfather said, "Don't get on your high horse. If you don't take this part, you may never work again." The assumption was that I wasn't good enough. At the time, I wasn't old enough, strong enough, or sophisticated enough to tell him that he was wrong. It was one of the times in my life when fear made the decision for me, and when fear makes the decision, it's a mistake. That job was 3 long, hard years, and the flying nun became a huge joke. It was deeply humiliating. I felt denigrated as a person. Oprah, that makes me want to cry. Sally, I'm sure it didn't seem so tragic to others. Many people must have looked at my life and thought I was quite fortunate. But I felt lousy about myself, and I didn't come from a place where I had a lot of self-confidence. And then during the show, I got married and became pregnant. You can only imagine what a pregnant flying nun looked like. Oprah, of course, of course. Sally, I was a walking sight gag, but I wasn't embarrassed by the fact that I was pregnant. In fact, something in me started to take care of myself in a way that I hadn't been able to before. I started to change and heal. I grew up and moved out of the fog. And ultimately, the experience of being on the series gave me tremendous strength. It made me want to be a real actor, no matter what. When you hold your feet to the fire long enough, you realize how much you don't like that fire. It hurts like holy hell. Oprah. After talking to you for a while, your 1985 Oscar speech for Places in the Heart, when you said, "You like me, you really like me," makes more sense. Sally. I was trying to own that for this one moment in time. This amazing thing was happening to me. I said, "I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me." That line has been interpreted in all sorts of ways. For me, it was about admitting that the moment was real. When you've had a career that lasts a while, the hard times impact you so greatly, especially if you allow yourself to feel them. They suck you in the stomach. The challenge is always to move forward out of them. Jay-Z. Let me say this. Reconnecting with my father changed me more than anything, because it allowed me to let people in. He left when I was 11, and after that I always had that wall up, and whenever someone got close to me, I would shut down. Oprah. So how did you get back in touch with your father? Jay. My mom set up a meeting between me and my father. I was like, "Ma, I'm a grown man. I don't need a dad now." But he showed up, and I gave him the real conversation. I told him how I felt the day he left. He was saying stuff like, "Man, you knew where I was." I'm like, "I was a kid. Do you realize how wrong you were? It was your responsibility to see me." He finally accepted that. Oprah. Did you instantly make peace with him during that conversation? Jay. Pretty much. I felt lighter. Oprah. The conversation freed you in ways that you hadn't been free before. Jay. 100%. Oprah. Many of the little boys who grew up where you did in Brooklyn's Marcy housing projects are either in jail or dead. Why do you think you got to grow up and buy your mom a house? Jay. There's the gift, there's the spirit, and there's the work. All three have to come together. If one of those things is off, it can stop you from becoming who you were meant to be. Maya Angelou. Oprah. You wrote in one of your poems that nobody can make it out here alone. Maya. Amen. Nobody, but nobody makes it out here alone. Oprah. Everybody needs somebody. Maya. And that's how love heals. The love of the family, the love of one person can heal. It heals the scars left by a larger society, a massive, powerful society. Oprah. Where do you go for solace, for comfort? Are there books that you read? When Maya Angelou needs comforting, where does she turn? Maya. I'm a student of Unity, the Unity Church. I took a course on Unity online, not to become a member or a minister, but just to understand more deeply. There's a book called Lessons in Truth, a core text of the Unity ministry. And in the book, there is a line, which is, "God loves me." Years ago, I read it to my then mentor, the late Frederick Wilkerson, and he said, "Read it again, read it again, read it again." And finally, I said, "God loves me," while I was crying. It still humbles me that this force that makes leaves and fleas and stars and rivers and you loves me. Me, Maya Angelou. It's amazing. I can do anything and do it well. Any good thing, I can do it. That's why I am who I am, yes, because God loves me and I'm amazed at it. I'm grateful for it. Our next article by Selena Yeager is titled, "No One I Know Talks About Menopause, But I'm on a Mission to Change That." It wasn't supposed to happen to me. I mean, I had been writing about menopause since I was 27, and really, let's talk about that. What the hell was I doing giving women in their 40s and 50s journalistic advice about the most massive tsunami of hormonal havoc since puberty? I was way closer to the age of learning how to use a tampon than that of figuring out how to have sex without whipping out some coconut oil. But I'm getting ahead of myself, because the only thing the women's health magazines I was working for at the time ever talked about, besides hot flashes, was the menopot, the pot belly that develops in so many women during midlife, which we said could be prevented by simply exercising more and eating tofu. I really truly thought menopause would be no big deal. Never mind that the actual list of menopausal symptoms from medical assessment check sheets includes, and is not limited to, Everything from hot flashes, lightheadedness and depression, to anxiety, vaginal dryness, and low libido. But again, I'm getting ahead of myself. I mean, I exercised, like really, really exercised. As a longtime fitness contributor to Bicycling Magazine, which I still am today, and a semi-professional bike racer, more semi than pro these days, but still out there, I was 100% confident I'd skate right through this shit. And I kinda almost did. Still racing well into my 40s, I thought I'd discovered the fountain of Menna Never Pause. I was also backstroking in a sea of sweet denial, seasoned with a pinch of perhaps willful ignorance. But somewhere around 47, I started waking up like clockwork at 2 a.m., projectile sweating like a Palm Springs lawn sprinkler, heart pounding and mind racing with thoughts of impending doom. Huh, that's weird, I thought at the time. I must be stressed, because, you know, we women are always stressed. The truth was, I was stressed, because I now know that the hormonal havoc of the menopausal transition, which can last for a decade, literally causes stress as your cortisol levels rise as your sex hormones decline. I kept a towel by my bedside and shrugged it off. It wasn't until I woke up at age 49, looked in the mirror, and barely recognized the figure staring back that I came face to face with reality. Oh shit, it's happening. Oh shit, what is happening? Seemingly overnight, the muscles I'd had my entire adult life had gone MIA. Instead, I had what I like to call fuel storage pantries and all sorts of places I'd never had fat before. Worse, I felt like someone pulled the plug on my power. Riding up hills I used to charge over, it felt like some divine entity had turned the gravity dial to 11. And there was nowhere to turn. People don't talk about menopause. The only time my mom had ever mentioned it was when she told me how her mother went crazy during the change. Cool, I have that to look forward to. From my experience, athletes are more likely to describe their morning bowel movements in vivid detail than they are to utter the M word. Why? Because menopause has stigma and shame attached to it. It means you're old. How we decided old is bad is a topic for another time. It means you're a golden girl, because that's how television portrayed menopausal women in the 80s and 90s, and those messages stuck. But I was lucky. I sat down with my now seasoned writer self, the one with the research chops who actually knows scientists studying hormones and health and performance, and made a call to Stacey Sims, PhD, author of Roar, How to Match Your Food and Fitness to Your Female Physiology for Optimum Performance, Great Health, and a Strong, Lean Body for Life. I was the co-writer on that book. I knew firsthand that there were ways you could work with your changing hormones during menstruation to feel good and stay on top of your game, whatever it was. We'd included a chapter on menopause. But it was clear that, though that information was solid, it wasn't enough. She talked me down and gave me a bunch of advice. Get in the gym and lift heavy. When estrogen goes, your muscles need extra assistance. Eat lots more protein. Keep the high-intensity exercise, but take more truly easy rest days. She recommended some adaptogens, herbs and roots used for healing, like ashwagandha to tame the stress. I developed an evening routine to help with sleep, and things got better. I'm not in the same shape at 52 that I was at 42. Stacy is a scientist, not a fairy godmother with a bag of magic pixie dust after all. But for the first time, I felt in control. There were concrete steps I could take. Those steps included writing another book with Dr. Sims for women in the menopausal transition. That's in the works. And starting a podcast, Hit Play, Not Pause, and an associated community via Facebook and Instagram for performance-minded menopausal women. More women needed to know they were not alone, that the menopausal transition was exactly that, a transition, not a dead-end street. And a funny thing happened when I picked up the microphone and opened my mouth. An army of active menopausal women came out of the shadows and shared their own struggles, how they'd wanted to quit doing the activities that they loved, how some had quit, how alone and invisible and hopeless they sometimes felt. Then they all started talking and helping each other, and feeling empowered to keep putting themselves out there in the gym or the starting lines at work and in life. I realize that this is how this perfectly natural, often challenging, but ultimately empowering life transition that 51% of the population experiences is finally going to come into the light and become a new beginning, not the end, for midlife women. One conversation at a time. Next article by Elena Nicolou is titled Apple CEO Tim Cook Tells Gayle King How Apple Is Supporting Minorities in Tech. Last year, as the world saw protests demanding racial justice, Apple committed $100 million toward expanding opportunities to communities of color in the tech industry. In a letter shared with employees and the public, Apple CEO Tim Cook wrote, "We must do more. We have to create change. We have to re-examine our own views and actions in light of the pain. To the Black community, we see you. You matter. Your lives matter." Recently, Apple unveiled its plan for creating that change. Speaking to Gayle King on CBS This Morning, Cook and Lisa Jackson, Vice President of Environment Policy and Social Initiatives, went into further detail about where the $100 million will be allocated. Initiatives include the Propel Center, a first-of-its-kind innovation and learning hub for students from historically Black colleges and universities, an Apple Developer Academy to support coding and tech education for students in Detroit, and venture capital funding for Black and Brown entrepreneurs. Bolstered by a $25 million donation from Apple, the Propel Center will work with 36 HBCUs in the U.S. to provide training and connections in tech. With a physical campus located in Atlanta University Center, the Propel Center will also offer a virtual platform and on-campus activations at partner institutions. Think of it as an innovation hub. We'll work on things from coding to machine learning to entertainment arts, Cook told Gayle King on This Morning. It's about giving people opportunity. Other areas of study include AI and machine learning, agricultural technologies, social justice, entertainment arts, app development, augmented reality, design and creative arts, career preparation, and entrepreneurship. According to Jackson, the Propel Center will be a place for Apple, as well as other tech companies, to plug into the HBCU talent pool. We know that the talent is already here. We know these students are trying to do what every student does, propel themselves to a better future and a better life, Jackson said. The center's name ties into its mission. Jackson described the center as a little bit of wind under students' sails. In collaboration with Michigan State University, Apple is also creating Apple Developer Academy in downtown Detroit. There, learners of all stages will learn to code and create apps. We want to give extra lift to Black and Brown developers, Jackson said. The Apple Developer Academy will offer two tiers of programs, a 30-day introductory program dipping into the app economy, and a 10- to 12-month training program. With these two tracks, Apple intends to reach 1,000 students per year. The company is also addressing systemic barriers to access and funding faced by Black and Brown entrepreneurs by making two major investments in the venture capital and banking spaces. Apple's $10 million investment, Harlem Capital, will seed 1,000 companies with diverse founders over the next 20 years. It will also invest $25 million in Siebert Williams Shank's Clear Vision Impact Fund, which looks to support businesses that operate in or serve underserved markets and that foster inclusive growth initiatives. Finally, Apple will be making a contribution to the King Center, a not-for-profit organization that honors the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., led by his daughter, Bernice King. This investment is significant considering how underrepresented people of color are in the tech industry. Per CNBC, Apple's workforce is 9% Black, but the figure drops to 3% when looking at leadership roles. Less than 5% of workers at Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn are Black, per the Chicago Sun-Times. Apple's initiative may impact the recruiting pipeline, which traditionally favors white men who make up a majority of the tech workforce. Every individual deserves equal access to opportunity regardless of skin color or zip code, Jackson said in a statement from Apple. For too long, communities of color have faced gross injustices and institutional barriers to their pursuit of the American dream, and we are proud to lend our voices and resources to build new engines of opportunity that empower, inspire, and create meaningful change. Our next article by Monica Schoen is titled, Barack Obama's Siblings Live All Around the World. After 8 years of the Obama presidency, it may feel as though we know everything there is to know about his family. Former First Lady Michelle Obama, daughters Malia and Sasha, brother-in-law Craig Robinson, and others have been by his side through his meteoric rise from U.S. Senator to the White House. But Barack Obama's larger extended family also includes a number of siblings who live around the world. Although Obama grew up with his maternal half-sister, Maya Soturo Ng, and remains close to her, he didn't have the chance to meet his other half-siblings until later on in life. Despite the distance, his paternal Obama siblings currently reside in Kenya, America, and China, and his increasing public profile, the former president has noted that his extended family has shaped who he is today. In the introduction of his best-selling 1995 memoir, Dreams from My Father, Obama noted, "It is to my family, though, my mother, my grandparents, my siblings, stretched across oceans and continents, that I owe the deepest gratitude and to whom I dedicate this book." Let's take a closer look at the larger Obama family, including his siblings on his maternal and paternal side. Here's everything we know. Maya Soturo Ng. Born in Jakarta, Indonesia, on August 15, 1970, Maya is the daughter of Ann Dunham, Obama's mother, and Lolo Soturo, his stepfather. The Indonesian-American grew up with her older brother, even graduating from the same Punu school in Hawaii. She went on to receive her undergraduate degree from Barnard College, her master's from New York University, and her PhD from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Since then, Maya went on to become an educator, teaching high school history in Honolulu before assuming a role as the director of the Spark M. Matsunga Institute for Peace based in Hawaii. She is also a consultant for the Obama Foundation, focusing specifically in the Asia-Pacific region. "He took his job as Big Brother seriously," Maya told USA Today in 2008. "Our mother divorced my father, and our grandfather died, so he really ended up being the man of the house." Even now, though the two are both fully grown adults, Maya revealed in a 2013 interview with the Seattle Times that Obama still calls her kid. Despite her older brother assuming the highest elected office in America, the two have maintained a close and warm relationship. During both the 2008 and 2012 presidential campaigns, Maya hit the campaign trail for her big brother, including taking on speaking roles at the Democratic National Convention both years. In addition, the siblings have been on family vacations to Indonesia together, as well as Christmases spent in Hawaii. Malik Obama. Born in Nairobi, Kenya in 1958, Obama's half-brother Malik now lives in their family's ancestral home of Naingoma Kugelo and runs an electronics shop in town, according to the Associated Press. Malik, who also has U.S. citizenship, previously lived and worked in Washington, D.C., according to Reuters. The two siblings share the same father, Barack Obama Sr., and met for the first time in 1985 in the U.S. At one point, the brothers enjoyed a relationship despite the geographic distance. "He was best man at my wedding, and I was best man at his," Malik told the Associated Press in 2004. However, it seems as though in recent years, Obama and Malik have drifted apart. In 2016, Malik made headlines when he criticized his brother's record in the White House and announced that he was supporting Donald Trump's presidential bid. He further stirred up controversy when he attended the third presidential debate in 2016 as Trump's guest. Ama Obama. Born in 1960 in Nairobi, Kenya, Ama Obama is the daughter of Barack Obama Sr., the 44th president's father, and his first wife. The Kenyan-British Ama eventually left her home country for Germany to pursue higher education, and afterward moved to England, where she and her mother got British citizenship. Now Ama lives in Kenya, where she runs the Sauti Kuu Powerful Voices Foundation, an organization she started to help young, underprivileged girls. According to a CNN interview, Obama and Alma met for the first time in their 20s after he invited her to Chicago. Alma noted, "I love my brother, what could I say? It's interesting that we met quite late in life. We hit it off." In 2012, she told Time magazine more about their first encounter. "I felt a kinship with him automatically. I was very nervous and worried about not connecting immediately and then having to be in his home because I was going to be staying with him. But when I met him, it was so easy. We just started talking as though we'd known each other always, and that was actually something really special." Obama even flew to England for Alma's wedding in 1997, according to the BBC. "I'm proud of our name because my brothers really carried our name up there. It's made its mark in the world," Alma told CNN. "And it's special for us and for our children and for our communities because it tells every child that if you work hard, you can do whatever you want in this world. You can make your future." Mark Okoth Obama Nejando. The oldest son of Barack Obama Sr. and his third wife, Ruth Baker, Mark was born in 1965 in Nairobi, Kenya. The two brothers met for the first time in 1988 in Kenya, according to an interview Mark did with the Times of Israel in 2014, and then met several more times in subsequent years. "We are very similar," Mark noted, pointing out that they were both mixed race, both attended Ivy League schools, and both had American mothers. "In some ways, our father runs through our lives, and as Barack said in his book, sons often spend their lives trying to achieve their father's dreams or correct their mistakes," he told the Times of Israel. "In a sense, Barack has been trying to achieve, and I've been trying to correct mistakes." Currently, Mark is based in Shenzhen, China, where he lives with his wife. In addition to being a businessman and musician, Mark has also published two books, Nairobi to Shenzhen, A Novel of Love in the East, and An Obama's Journey, My Odyssey of Self-Discovery. David Nejando. Mark's younger brother David was born in 1967 to Barack Obama Sr. and Baker, is also one of Obama's siblings. Although it's not clear exactly when he passed, according to Politico, he passed away in a motorcycle accident. George Hussein Onyango Obama. Obama's youngest half-brother, George, was born in 1982 in Kenya. According to the Daily Telegraph, George has only spoken with his older brother a few times, but he noted in 2008 that when you have a brother who wants to be the number one most important person in the world, it obviously gives you a lot of inspiration. The younger Obama, who lived in Nairobi's Huruma slum at the time of his 2008 interview, added, "There was a long time when I was just taking a break, doing nothing, trying to find myself and what I wanted to do. Now I am more focused on my future, and I can say it is because I understand more about things because of hearing what Barack is doing." Our next article by Jen Shapland is titled, "Finding Carson McCullough's Secret Love Letters Helped Me Realize Who I Am." The titles of Carson McCullough's books had always struck a chord with me. "The Heart is a Lonely Hunter," like, same. But I'd never gotten around to reading any of her work. Books seem to find me when I'm ready for them. Hers didn't until the second year of my PhD program, when I was an intern at the Harry Ransom Center, which houses a giant collection of writers' and artists' books, papers, photographs, and artworks at the University of Texas at Austin. One day a scholar wrote asking for letters between McCullers and Anne-Marie Cleric Schwarzenbach, whose name was utterly unfamiliar to me. I took the freight elevator to the icy basement manuscript room, pulled the correspondence folder, it was labeled 29.4, I still recall, and started reading it right there in the stacks. The paper was browned with age and wrinkled at the edges. Anne-Marie's handwriting filled the page, which I read through the clear Mylar sleeves. "Carson, child, my beloved. You know that, leaving the day after tomorrow, feeling half afraid and proud, leaving behind me all I care for, once again, and a wave of love." I looked up at the rows of manuscript boxes that surrounded me, mind humming, face flushed. Love? Did that mean what I thought it did? Instinctively, I listened for anyone who might be coming. Hearing only the tick-tick of the sliding electric shelves, I read on. To Carson, Anne-Marie recalled, talking as we did, you and I, at that lunchtime, you remember, at the corner near the Bedford Hotel, with milk and bread and butter, ages ago. Anne-Marie's language in her letters to Carson was intimate, suggestive, or at least I read it that way. You remember. I had received letters like these. I had written letters like these to women I'd loved. Letters with words like darling and baby. Another thing I recognized, the intimacy of Anne-Marie's tone contained a hint of plausible deniability, as though the wave of love she referred to might not have been about Carson at all. It was very little to go on, yet I felt utter certainty. Carson McCullers had loved women, or at least this woman had loved her. I wanted to know everything about them both. I brought the folder upstairs, hurried to my 3 o'clock reference desk shift, and started Googling. Anne-Marie, I discovered, was a Swiss writer, photographer, silk heiress, and known lady killer, who spent time in New York in the late 1930s and early 40s, but there wasn't much else. Folder 29.4 held 8 letters from Anne-Marie to Carson, but none of Carson's replies. One had the heading, On the Congo River, September 1941. Anne-Marie's handwriting was so small and insistent that the missives read long, though often they covered only the front and back of a single sheet. Like mine, they were overwrought, wrung with feeling and a need to declare it in writing. Other than my own, I had never read love letters between women before. I found the letters at the tail end of the slow-burning catastrophe of my 20s, never quite breaking up with my first love, a woman I'd met our freshman year of college, after 6 closeted years together. I didn't know whether I wanted to date women, but on the heels of emotional and sexual manipulation by a male professor, the idea of dating men seemed pretty dismal. Like most 25-year-olds, I couldn't figure out what came next. What came next was Carson. I tried to tell a few people about the letters, but I couldn't explain why they were so significant to me. She dated a woman, they'd say. So? The years that followed were overtaken by my desire to understand the magnitude of Carson and Anne-Marie's on-paper love, and to understand myself, too. I didn't realize I was starting a book that would take me 7 years to research and write. Within a week of finding the letters, without seeing any connection to the photos of Anne-Marie I'd been Googling, I would chop my hair short. Within a year, I would be calling myself a lesbian for the first time, albeit only privately, in my mind and to a few close friends. Having grown up Catholic in the Midwest, I struggled to claim my own sexuality. I was still trying it out, working to get the words out of my mouth. 4 years later, I would live in Carson's childhood home for a month on a research fellowship, and soon after I would move to Santa Fe with my new love, Chelsea. We met as interns, abandoning my academic job search to finish a book about Carson. Retrospect redefines everything in its path, and I am as hesitant to ascribe fixed narrative meaning to my own life as any other. But I suppose we could call those letters a turning point. Our next article by Jill Heinerth is I Dive into Caves for a Living. Here's what it's taught me about overcoming fear. There are places of beauty and wonder deep inside the planet where no man or woman has ventured. As a cave diving explorer, my dark workplace terrifies most people. I swim alone through the claustrophobic blackness of water-filled caves where an air on the job may measure my chance of survival in single breaths. This highly technical underwater pursuit has claimed the lives of dozens of my friends. Beyond the scientific discoveries and new maps that I have brought home from expeditions, cave diving has also taught me valuable lessons about how to survive and thrive in life. Here are 5 lessons cave diving has taught me about overcoming fear. Step into the darkness. Fear is a healthy emotion that lets us know that we care about future outcomes, but is also capable of causing emotional paralysis. I'm scared when I go diving. I look at that as a good thing. To succeed, I have learned to visualize everything that can go wrong and mentally rehearse the solutions before I hit the water. Then if, for example, I get entangled in a safety line, I will know how to cut and repair it in the dark. Self-awareness and personal growth have followed my frightening experiences, so I seek them out. Recognize your mortality. Facing fear, even death, while thoughtfully engaging in risk can be very life-affirming. After getting trapped inside an iceberg cave and making a meticulous but harrowing escape, I felt intoxicated with accomplishment. I have lost experienced colleagues that were not as fortunate, so I don't take my training for granted. I practice hard, accept the risks, and experience gratitude every day. Breathe deep. When I am trapped in a blinding blackout of silt and have lost the safety line, it is easy to panic. My primal brain tries to take over, seizing control of my heart and lungs, but in the face of great danger, I have learned that it is far better to turn off that primal instinct of fight or flight by taking slow, deep breaths. In controlling my breathing and heart rate, I can postpone otherwise crippling emotions and focus on the next correct decision. With practice, I can remain calm, inhaling thoughtfulness and pragmatism that helps me take careful steps to find the lost guideline and ultimately safety. Don't get me wrong, I am not without emotion. After I solve the problem at hand, I have plenty of room to acknowledge the experience and even have a well-earned cry. Understand the scope. Big problems are not solved quickly. In a cave restriction no taller than the space beneath your couch, a panicking diver became the cork in the bottle containing my life. I had to calm her down, repair our broken safety line, and manage a failing breathing system. At that moment, trapped in the confinement of a silty cave with broken life support gear, the chattering gremlins in my head were very loud. It was tough to conjure up a vision of survival. Recognizing that I needed to take the next small yet decisive step toward a positive outcome saved my life. For 73 minutes beyond my dive plan, small victories added up, even as rescuers were rushing to the scene expecting to recover my dead body. Now I know that small, decisive actions add up to big successes. Embrace failure. It would be easy to give up cave diving after getting trapped in a cave, but each incident or aborted dive has informed me through discovery. The sum of the good, bad, and terrifying experiences in my life is not an epic failure. As a young woman, abandoning a business, filing for divorce, and fighting off an attacker were scary milestones. Facing the deaths of close colleagues has been devastating, but the entirety of those life experiences has made me wiser and stronger. By embracing every aspect of my life, I have made significant discoveries that have built who I am today. Our next article by Lacey Johnson is titled, "The Most Common Reasons for Divorce, According to Marriage Counselors." Falling in love is a thing of elation, and then there's the wedding day. Two partners star in their own rom-com, vows are spoken, the audience claps, and the newlyweds ride off into the sunset together, with decades of marital bliss on the horizon. Their love will surely stand the test of time, or will it? In fact, what if there comes a day when the marriage simply becomes loveless? In the honeymoon phase, the prospect of divorce may feel light years away. But the reality of making a marriage work is not as simple as a stroll down the aisle. While all relationships experience trials, and even the healthiest couples fluctuate in terms of mutual happiness, unfortunately, some differences prove to be irreconcilable, even toxic. We linked up with some experts who enlightened us to the most common reasons couples seek divorce, as well as topics that show up in marital counseling sessions and in the courtroom. So if thoughts of divorce are blinking on your radar, ahead is a wealth of information to help you validate whether or not your happily ever after has become better off apart. So what are the most common reasons marriages fall apart? Divorce attorney Kelly Frawley, partner at Casawitz Benson Torres LLP, claims to have heard it all from "I can't stand his family" to protests over a partner's changing body. The two most common reasons echoing throughout her practice, however, money battles and relational boredom. Couples may disagree about spending habits as well as the bigger financial picture in terms of savings and retirement goals, she says. And then there's the boredom piece. when the sense of adventure and passion has lost its pulse. Frawley says this often happens when couples lose their ability to relate day to day. People may find they do not share the same interests as they once did, or they're not excited about being intimate with their spouse. Frawley's observations are well aligned with a recent divorce study where roughly 40% of its participants cited financial issues and getting married too young as having been major players in their marriage's demise. Infidelity and conflict were mentioned even more, with almost 60% of the participating divorcees admitting that extramarital affairs and excessive arguing were among their final straws. But the most shouted complaint of all? A lack of commitment, coming in at a whopping 75%. There's no one year of marriage that you're most vulnerable to divorce. Dr. Lori Whatley, clinical psychologist, licensed marriage and family therapist, and author of Connected and Engaged, says that there does seem to be a popular time to get divorced, regardless of whether you've been together for 2 years or 20. Intense periods of adjustment. The first year is extremely hard and often comes with surprises because it's a merging of beliefs, separate family traditions, and financial habits in order to create a new family unit, she says. And for couples who decide to toss a child into the mix, the surprises don't end there. When children are introduced, it can be an absolute shock for a lot of couples, says Dr. Whatley. Say, for example, when partners trade in their sexy, wine-drenched date nights and spontaneous weekend getaways for a sleep-deprived blur of feeding, burping, and changing diapers. Or there could be issues with an interfering in-law whose heightened presence as a grandparent negatively bleeds over into the way one views their spouse. Regardless, Dr. Whatley has observed that if a couple is already struggling to harmonize their personalities and goals, the newfound responsibility of a child may put further strain on the marriage. Finally, empty nesters are often struck with yet another challenging stretch. After years spent hauling kids to music lessons and sporting practices, many couples suddenly find themselves seated alone at a quiet dinner table, sometimes unable to organically lock eyes. Some partners aren't sure they can connect with each other privately anymore, she says. They may have neglected their intimacy for years, and then there's nothing left to salvage. Emily Pollack, partner at Kasowitz Benson Torres LLP, says that while her firm represents individuals in all stages of marriage, she has noticed that the majority of cases are closer to the middle of the spectrum, between 7 and 14 years. Unmet expectations is another top cause of divorce. Sometimes spouses discover that they clash. From personality conflicts to glaring political differences, perhaps there has been no single eruptive event and there is no one person to blame. They just want to be shown the exit door. Dr. Whatley explains that the first year or two of a romance is fueled by a cocktail of chemicals like dopamine and oxytocin, creating an intoxicating haze of blind distraction. But then the intoxication runs out and any red flags that were once ignored have taken center stage. When the body physiologically calms down and you're no longer crazy in love, you're doing real life together. And you may realize that you and your spouse are fundamentally different people, she says. Dr. Whatley adds that based upon her observations, the most common reason for irreconcilable differences is unmet expectations. People often create all of these expectations that their spouse will eventually adjust certain behaviors or habits to better suit their own. But you can never change another person. You can only change yourself. Of course, infidelity is another leading reason. However, Dr. Whatley says it doesn't have to be a deal breaker. Infidelity is almost always a symptom of another problem. While some marriages never heal from it, I have seen many couples create even better marriages after working through the issues surrounding it, she says. Dena Babul, relationship expert and author of the upcoming book Love Strong, Change Your Narrative, Change Your Life, and Take Your Power Back, agrees. If a marriage has a solid foundation that over time becomes compromised in some way, infidelity can happen in marriages that are ultimately worth saving, so long as the person who cheated is genuinely remorseful and committed to rebuilding the relationship's trust, she says. But there is a catch. In order to come back from infidelity, the person who was betrayed must still be able to see their spouse in a recognizably loving light. If the person is so hurt that they are no longer able to see their spouse as the one they fell in love with, that may ultimately destroy the marriage, says Babul. In a 2019 survey, lack of intimacy was cited as one of the most prevalent factors. In a 2019 study published by Journal of Sex and Marital Therapy, the most common reason for divorce was found to be a lack of love and intimacy. Dr. Shannon Chavez, LA-based psychologist and sex therapist, says that sexless marriages are shockingly common and that the majority of her divorce clients report having experienced its pain. In sexless marriages, a person can go a long time without feeling desired and loved, and their self-esteem can take serious hits because of it, she says. So, in such a case, it's understandable why a person might wish to leave a marriage that's left them untouched for months or years. But Dr. Chavez urges her clients to consider that while eroticism fades over time, a seemingly flatline sex life doesn't necessarily mean that divorce papers should be filed. If there is still a connection there, couples can work to check in with each other's desires and find new ways to excite and indulge in each other. Unless there are other serious issues within the marriage, in the majority of cases, it's definitely possible to revive the intimacy and sexual connection, she says. At the end of the day, divorce happens because a marriage has lost its glue. Regardless of the reasons that provoke thoughts of divorce, how does one know when it's really over? Dr. Whatley says it's when the marriage has lost its glue. You know that special thing you bond over that has always held you together in conflict, in tragedy, or after a huge mistake. Couples can come back from so many awful things, but only when the glue is still there. If it's lost, if it starts to feel indifferent, that's when the marriage falls apart. She adds, and that is when it is nearly impossible to be put back together. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.